Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. My office here at WNYC is right next to Jad Abumrad's office. You know Jad, the host of Radiolab. So occasionally I'll hear Jad editing one of his pieces, because he is right next door, and because he has his speakers up to 11! Anyway, there have been one or two times over the years where Radiolab has been putting a piece together and I've been left thinking, wow, I wish we could air that. Well, tonight, I get my wish, because our friends at Radiolab took an unexpected detour into the world of hip-hop, with a somewhat different perspective, and they've given it to us to air exclusively on Soundcheck. You won't even hear it on their show, only here. So that's coming up in a bit, and the reason we've chosen this episode of Soundcheck to broadcast the piece is because it matches up really well with my first guest, who just happens to be one of the major figures in rap history.
Now, why did you do it? You know you got the mad fat fluid when you rhyme. It's halftime.
The rapper, songwriter, entrepreneur, and actor Nasir Jones is known to hip-hop fans everywhere simply as Nas. His 1994 debut album, Illmatic, is still considered one of hip-hop's finest moments, with its unflinching look at poverty, race, class, and spirituality, all seen through the lens of a then-20-year-old resident of a Queens housing project. That album is now 20 years old, there's a reissue, a documentary film about the making of the record, even orchestral performances of the album. Nas, you are one busy guy these days.
Yeah, I am, John.
Thanks for spending some time with us on Soundcheck today.
Sure.
So, you played this record front to back. Was it the
National Symphony?
The National Symphony
in D.C.
How did that sound?
Different. It was different. It was a lot softer, a lot of strings. You know, it was really incredible, though. I really take my hat off to them. They learned the music really quick.
And, mm-hmm. Now, when you were making this record, did you ever think of it? I mean, you certainly wouldn't have thought of it as an orchestral piece, but did you think of it as a live performance piece?
Yeah, I did. And I even thought about it like being, like giving it a kind of theater kind of vibe, giving a theater vibe to the audience at some point. At one point, I did think like this could be a play or something like that. You know, I think a lot of us, you know, have dreams like that for at least a second in the beginning, you know. But I never knew it would happen.
So the idea, I mean, a lot of people now are asking you to look back at the 20-year-old Nas and to kind of revisit what you were doing. What were you doing?
Well, you know, I was just being welcomed into fatherhood. You know, I had a daughter and I had an album. My first album, Illmatic, it changed my life. Those two things changed my life drastically. So what I was doing was enjoying myself, and I was really similar to how I am now. So, I mean, I was the same old boring guy.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, whether you recognize 20 years later that 20-year-old kid, the one who wrote, you know, Life's a Bitch.
Yeah, I do. He was a guy who was just really happy to have an opportunity to put his words to music and have major distribution and put it out there. I was just really grateful.
We're talking with Nas about his now 20-year-old hip-hop classic, the album called Illmatic. Here's a little bit from that song, Life's a Bitch.
When I was younger, this I used to do my thing hard. Robbing foreigners, take their wallets, their jewels, and rip their green cards. Dip to the projects, flashing my quick cash, and got my first piece of ass smoking blunts with hash. Now it's all about cash in abundance. Niggas I used to run with is rich, are doing years in the hundreds. I switched my motto. Instead of saying, tomorrow, that buck that bought a bottle could have struck the lotto. Once I stood on the block, loose tracks, produced stacks. I cooked up and cut small pieces to get my loot back. Time is Illmatic, keep static like wool fabric. Pack a formatic to crack your whole cabbage.
Life's a bitch and then you die. That's why we get high.
Life's a Bitch from the 1994 album Illmatic by my guest Nas, the rapper, songwriter, and actor. There is a documentary about the making of this record, which is opening the Tribeca Film Festival on Wednesday, and Nas is with us on Soundcheck today. On Life's a Bitch, there's the sound of what is usually called a trumpet. It's actually a cornet, isn't it?
That's right.
Played by your dad, Olu Dara. Yeah. Is it okay if I geek out about your dad for a moment?
Please do.
Because in the early 80s, mid-80s, you know, he was like this really kind of central player with people like Henry Threadgill and James Blood Olmer playing the cornet.
Yeah.
And I thought that's who Olu Dara, your dad, that's who he is. He's this jazz cornetist. Mm-hmm. Then a number of years later, he turns up with this kind of swampy, bluesy guitar stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, that's Olu Dara as well.
Right.
And then after that, it's like, oh, and his son is the rapper Nas.
Yeah.
So a guy with kind of, you know, all these musical surprises. Is there a musical side of you that we don't know about?
No surprises. Nothing I see, you know. Maybe down the line, like you said, he's this cornet playing jazz musician at first, and then he evolves into, he goes back into his roots. He's from Mississippi, Natchez,
right.
Mississippi, so naturally those roots came out. And so my roots are just New York, so I don't know what's going to happen, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, you started with your roots. I mean, Illmatic is kind
it.
Of a... You were talking before how you almost saw it as kind of a play. It's
yeah.
like this is what life was like in Queensbridge.
Yeah.
What is it about Queensbridge that has made it? I mean, it's this, for folks who don't know, it's this housing project. It's officially in Long Island City.
Long Island City, yeah.
And, I mean, per capita, I think more hip-hop has come out of Queensbridge than anywhere else.
It's really crazy. As a kid, when you were listening to my pops here and there and other jazz or whatever, I was listening to hip-hop, but there was DJ Molly Mall and MC Shan and Roxanne Shante and all these groups were coming out of my hood, and I was like, this is crazy. They really made a name for themselves and were proud to be where, you know, where we were from. So when it was my turn at the bat, you know, I was kind of taking on their taking the torch from them.
So there was already a tradition.
There was a tradition there.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then after you, the guys from Mobb Deep.
Mobb Deep, Capone and Noriega, as a couple of people.
When you were making Illmatic, you know, were you aware of making some kind of statement about East Coast, you know, the sound of New York City rap, or were you just doing what came naturally?
It was what came natural. And what came natural was representing New York City to the fullest. But it wasn't like I was like I was out there purposely, like intentionally, like that was the focus, was to represent New York only. It was just to represent MCing hip hop music, and it just so happened I'm from New York.
Right.
So with that being said, New York had to be represented to the fullest.
Which, you know, both its good and its bad parts. So, you know, there's
New York is the greatest city in the world, no question about it. I love Paris. I love a few other nice places out there. But, you know, New York's the greatest. And
very different from what it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's really, it's big time different. It's a big time difference now. But, you know, it's still real.
So what did your dad think when he first heard Illmatic?
I think he had to be really proud. You know, he had to be really proud because he saw the hip-hop thing happening. He always loved it. He always thought it was a cool thing that young kids were on to something and they made something out of nothing and all of that stuff. So he was always a big-time supporter, whereas other jazz guys may have hated it. You know what I mean?
Until those royalty checks started coming in.
Until the royalties came in from the sampling, you guys, and now you love us. It's all good. It's all good.
Actually, Illmatic, I mean, that album was one of the first major records with the many, you know, the multiple producers. You had Q-Tip and DJ Premier and all these other guys.
Pete Rock. And, yeah, but, you know, at that time, I'd say this a lot of interviews, but it's still funny to me that at that point when I was working on Illmatic, every rap album was like in-house producers were there. Like you had one guy doing the whole thing, one or two guys basically doing an entire record. I was a new guy, and I didn't have a one guy to go to, really, to do the whole record. So I had a wish list of these great producers who were established artists, Pete Rock, Gangstar, Main Source, A Tribe Called Quest. So I was lucky enough that they liked what I was doing, and they wanted to help me put this record together. So that's how the – so after that, every record had, like, the top producer – every rap album, they would grab just top producers, and each song would be produced by another great producer. And so, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, since you wrote or co-wrote all of the songs, it doesn't sound like a hodgepodge. It's – I mean, it's –
It's a marriage. Yeah. Each song is married to each other. Each song is an extension of the other.
We're speaking with Nas, the rapper and songwriter, about his now 20-year-old album Illmatic being re-released as Illmatic 20. There's a new documentary about the record we can talk about in a moment. But at the beginning of New York State of Mind, famously, we actually kind of hear you wondering, how am I going to get into this?
Yeah.
I mean, is that really – was that so improvisational in the making?
Yeah. It was – you know, I knew it would be the beginning of the album. For some reason, I knew that song would be the first song on the album. So it's like, here it is for all the people that was waiting. You know, here's the record. It's starting. And I'm like, okay. They're listening. I got their attention. You know, I did some previous stuff, and now people were expecting the album. So here it is, and I'm like – in the beginning of the record, I think I say, I don't know how to start this shit, man. Alright. You know, and then I go in.
I don't know how to start this shit. Rappers are monkey flipping with the funky rhythm. I be kicking, musician, inflicting composition of pain. I'm like Scarface, sniffing cocaine, holding an M16. See, with the pen, I'm extreme. Now, bullet holes left in my peepholes. I'm suited up with street clothes. Hand me a 9 and out, defeat foes. Y'all know my steelo, with or without the airplay. I keep some E and J, sitting bent up in the stairway. Or either on the corner, betting grants with the CeeLo champs. Laughing at bass heads, trying to sell some broken amps. G-packs get off quick, forever niggas talk. Reminiscing about the last time the task force flipped. Niggas be running through the block shooting. Time to start the revolution. Catch a body head for Houston once they caught us off guard. The Mac-10 was in the grass and I ran like a cheetah with thoughts of an assassin. Picked the Mac up, told brothers back up. The Mac spit, lead was hitting niggas, one ran. I made a Mac.
Little bit of the song New York State of Mind by my guest Nas from the rapper and songwriter's debut album Illmatic. It was your full-length debut. You'd done some stuff before, as you mentioned before.
Yeah, I'd done small parts on two different records, or other people's records. I was featured on two different songs, Main Source and then MC Search. And then this was the album. Yep.
Illmatic from 1994. Now it's Illmatic 20, which has been remastered. There are some additional remixes and outtakes, etc. Then there's the film. How do you make a film about the making of a record 20 years after the fact?
It came to me. Well, I didn't make the film. It's by this guy, 1-9, and Eric Parker and their whole team. They were working on this film for maybe 6 years or something like that, and I wouldn't have anything to do with any films about me or my records or anything. I liked these guys. I had met them. They talked to me about it. They had done all this work, and I had wished them well, but I didn't want to participate with anything. It wasn't until last year, and these guys were not letting up, and they were like, you got to get in this film. They weren't pests at all. They were just cool, but they were like, you know, this is important. I don't think you get it. These people are involved. These people... And once I started to notice how many people they had interviewed, how many people were now involved who liked the film, who wanted this film to be seen, who were giving it legs, I knew this thing is going to go on without me. It's going to be sad. If you know, how would I feel later? I said, you know, I'm going to join in. I joined in, and I gave them my interviews, and my brother came on and gave him some great stories, and at this, we're so excited that we did it now. It's like, it does feel like a real movie or something.
Did you learn anything? Any surprises?
Yeah, man. It was really, I mean, they did a great job. The film plays with the grittiness to it, the way the album is, and they really capture that time period, and I had to, it took me back into that time. So, yeah, it's a couple of things I learned Yeah.
So that the film is called Time is Illmatic, and it opens the Tribeca Film Festival on Wednesday. I assume you'll be there.
I'll be there. I'm actually performing after you watch it.
You're going to do the whole?
I'm going to do the whole album.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not with an orchestra this time.
No. not this time.
Let's hear a little bit of this song called The World Is Yours. When you're listening back to the remastered version of this now, are you hearing things you didn't hear the first time around? Is it audibly different to you?
Usually I can hear a lot of mistakes, a lot of things I would have done differently, but I wouldn't change a thing with this.
I'm the young city bandit, hold myself down single-handed. For murder raps, I kick my thoughts alone, get remanded. Born alone, die alone, no crew to keep my crown or throne. I'm deep, I sound alone, cave inside 1,000 miles from home. I need a new nigga for this black cloud to follow, cause while it's over me, it's too dark to see tomorrow. Trying to maintain, I flip, feel the clip to the tip. Picturing my peeps, not eating, can make my heartbeat skip. And I'm amped up, they like to champ up, even my brain's in handcuffs. Headed for Indiana, stabbing women like the Phantom. The crew is lapping, Big Willie style. Check the chip to smell. Plus smile. I profile wow. Stash through the flock clothes, burning dollars to light my stove. Walk the blocks with a bop. Checking Danes plus the games people play. Bust the problems of the world today.
It's yours.
The world is yours. From the album Illmatic by my guest Nas, joining us here in the Soundcheck studio. Time is Illmatic is the name of the documentary about the making of this 1994 hip-hop classic. It opens the Tribeca Film Festival. Are you sick of explaining the word Illmatic?
No, not at all.
Explain the word Illmatic.
well, ill means sick. That car is ill. So Illmatic is just like the epitome. It's like the top of sick, of ill. So it's just like saying, "Yo, man, this interview is Illmatic. That ring she had on is Illmatic. You know, so it just encompasses so much."
And again, you mentioned this before, that it was kind of reflective of life in Queensbridge, in the housing projects, in the early 1990s.
Yes, sir.
Are you aware of these court cases where people are being tried for murder on the basis of their rap lyrics, where lyrics are being used as evidence in court?
Yeah, I heard about that.
What do you make of that?
Well, I think if you're going to kill somebody and then rap about it,
putting aside the stupidity factor that if you're going to kill somebody and then rap about it, you deserve what you get. But the idea that in some of these cases, the rap lyrics are practically the only evidence?
That's sketchy. I mean, I can't see how that can hold up. Like, how does rap lyrics really hold up as real evidence in a courtroom? When most of the time people are rapping, it's just a braggadocious thing. It's like not even real. Like, it's not real. They're just rapping about an attitude and a crazy murderous lifestyle that is more of a fantasy. It's not real. So you can't really take a fantasy and apply it and put it in a courtroom and put someone in jail because they had a moment in a studio.
Right. NPR on All Things Considered the other night was doing a story about this where actually the prosecutors were taking the idea of keeping it real. You know, well, here are these lyrics, and we all know it's all about keeping it real. Therefore, the lyrics must be real.
Well, they need like interpreters. They need like translators. They need someone in there that can really explain to them, you know, the difference between entertainment and reality.
Yeah. We're speaking with Nas here in the Soundcheck studio. He's released 9 solo albums. 6 of them have been number one records. His 1994 debut, Illmatic, is being reissued as Illmatic 20. There's the new documentary. You mentioned it took you a while to get on board with the documentary. Is it weird to be asked to think about your influence, you know, your kind of status as at the ripe old age of 40 as an elder statesman?
Well, the people who come before me, you know, as somebody in music, I think about my musical influences are Marvin Gaye, Michael Jackson, Madonna, Eric B., Slick Rick, Run DMC. They vary. And, you know, the people around me influence me. Other musicians, current musicians, contemporary stuff.
Like who?
Drake, Jay-Z, Outkast reuniting this year.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really exciting. That kind of thing makes me think about, you know, what's the next step for me? Those kind of guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the next step for you?
Well, I don't know, man. I really don't know. Taking it day by day.
All right. We've been speaking with Nas, the rapper, songwriter, and actor. Time is Illmatic opens the Tribeca Film Festival on Wednesday and will be followed by a performance of the record by Nas. And it's been great fun having you with us here in the Soundcheck studio.
Thanks, John. It's been real.
This is Soundcheck.
See you on the next VI. I gave you my Duke's loop for kicks, plus sent your flicks. Your brother's buck wildin' in Fort Maine. He wrote me, he might be this case, silly. Come on, I'm playing low key. So stay civilized, time flies, no incarcerated, your mind dies. I hate it when your mom's cries. It kinda makes me wanna murder, for realer. I even got a mask and gloves to bust us for one love.
One love, one love.
Coming up. A new podcast from our friends at Radiolab explores the idea of authenticity in hip-hop. We'll take a listen in just a moment. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. So, we just heard from Nas, one of the premier hip-hop artists of the last 20 years, talking about, among other things, his scrappier years as an underground artist. Now it's time for a look at a radio personality that's helped break a lot of underground hip-hop artists. And in doing so, this person has become something of an arbiter of what's authentic in the genre, or what some fans simply call real hip-hop. Peter Rosenberg of the New York station Hot 97 was recently the subject of a great profile in The New Yorker written by Andrew Marantz. Rosenberg and Marantz have teamed up with Radiolab to talk about Rosenberg's career, his role in the world of hip-hop, and an infamous spat that he was involved in. We'll let the Radiolab team take it away. Here's Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich.
Okay, so Robert, here's a question that I've been puzzling over for a long time.
Okay.
What is the fruitiest fruit that you know?
My fruitiest fruit is a plum.
Well, no. I mean, that's yours. I don't want to take that away from you.
No, you shouldn't.
But when you ask most people that question, they say apple or orange. No, I mean, it's true. Scientists have figured out that when you make a category in your mind, you're not doing it based on like a set list of traits. You're like, what you do is you call to mind the prototypical example of that category, and then you measure this new thing against it. And for fruits, prototype is the gala apple, if you ask me, the red, shiny, waxy apple.
You say there's somebody who's decided that an apple is the fruity fruit?
They've done experiments.
Oh, they've done experiments.
They've done experiments.
I bet you bananas outpoll apples for consumption.
Maybe. But that's not what makes a fruitiest fruit a fruity fruit. It's more about like how well it represents the category.
Okay.
That's what it's about.
Why are we talking about this, though?
Well, because I've been wanting to explore this in story form.
Forever. But you never have a story, so it's like you never find a story.
But I got one now.
You did? What?
It's not about fruit, though.
What is it about?
It's about this.
That's what... what is it? What are you talking about?
Let me explain.
Hey.
So we met this guy, Andrew Marantz.
I work at The New Yorker as an editor, and I write stuff occasionally.
Wandered in here one day by mistake, I think.
Super interesting guy, great reporter. And he ended up talking with us about this story he was reporting for The New Yorker about hip-hop.
There are all kinds of rappers who are trying to sing.
And how hip-hop might be changing. Because as we all know, this was a genre of music that began in a really specific time and place. Bronx, 70s, black and Latino kids. But it's since expanded so much that these inevitable questions pop up.
You know, to really simplify it, the more white people come to the party, the more you kind of start going, okay, at what point is it, it's clearly okay if everyone in the room is black. And it's okay if everyone in the room is black except for one guy. You know, if Rick Rubin's at the party, but it's still, you know, black people at the tunnel, in 1989 or whatever, it's still okay. But at what point, okay, if it's 50% white, if it's 75% white, if all the people who own the record labels are white, if a majority of the popular rappers are white, like at what point, and that's just the racial thing.
Yeah.
Then there's also the sonically the way it sounds, there's the way the production is kind of merged with other forms of music. So then all of a sudden you're at a point where you get the sense that there's somehow inherently that there's something being replaced or taken over.
Mm-hmm.
You start to have this dilemma.
Which is, you know, who owns the music now?
And the dilemma is obviously heightened by the fact that everyone knew this was coming. Like, there's never been a form of American popular music, as far as I know, that wasn't invented by black people and co-opted by white people.
And Andrew, in his piece and in this story, focuses on a guy who sits right at the heart of that dilemma. One of the most influential DJs in hip-hop today. Peter Rosenberg, is that his name?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So tell me how you came to him.
I mean, the first thing was
Hot 97, the most important hip-hop radio station in the world.
Listening to
Hot 97.
Because I like rap and I want to know what is popular. Mm-hmm. And I was listening and I heard this guy who they kept calling Rosenberg.
Rosenberg.
And I was like, is that Rosenberg? Is that like Whoopi Goldberg Rosenberg? Like, what does that mean? Uh-huh. And then I looked him up and I was like, no, it's just a guy named Peter Rosenberg.
1-2-1-2-1-2-1-2. I mean, listen, doing NPR is already pretty soft. You know what I'm saying?
He actually works just down the block from us.
Is this going to hurt your cred in some sense?
I know, possibly.
So he's a guy born in 1979. He grew up in...
I grew up in Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Chevy with a CH?
Yes, it is.
And Peter says when he was about 9, his brother...
My brother's name is Nick Rosenberg.
His brother started staying up late making tapes.
DJ Red Alert, Marley Marl. He would start taping those guys on the radio.
At that point, 1987, 98, here in New York, they were the only two people playing hip-hop, and it was late at night.
And at the time, I didn't consider myself a music person. I was only 8, but I really was like, oh, music's okay, but I'm just obsessed with sports. And then at some point, I was like, oh, no. I love this.
It was punk, it was rebellious, it was interesting, it was just cool.
You know, now, to be honest, it's almost cliched when people say that, like, who would ever guess you'd be into hip-hop? I'm like, I don't know. I would, because I know a million white kids who are into hip-hop. At that time, though, it was not common. It was very much something that was a badge of honor for both of us, that we really, really loved it. And I was extra cool, because I was super young. I remember one day, here's a great thing, I traded Javon my Poison tape. I had Poison's album on tape. Ooh. Every Rose Has a Thorn album. I traded that Poison tape for his Bismarck Key tape. I was like, this is the best trade ever. It was Biz is going off. Like, it's a classic album. And then at some point, my dad went out. He was coming home from work one day, and he said he stopped at Nobody Beats the Wiz. He asked the guy behind the counter what, like, the good rap albums were. And the kid actually gave him a pretty good recommendation, and he bought me a tape called Girls, I Got 'Em Locked by Super Lover C and Casanova Rudd.
What a father you have.
I know. Funky, dope, and you're stupid. I'm still your entertainer, causing you to get down. Bust a soup and rocket punk without doing the James Brown. So my knowledge base was always very high, very early. I had some friends in elementary school, and we would talk about rap a little bit, but quickly I exceeded them. And then I got to high school, and I really took seriously being the rap guy. When I heard The Passion in Public Enemy, like, that resonated with me. Like, I think N.W.A. scared me. But made me interested. I just thought this is I was like, yo, these guys are killing people. Like, this is really happening.
Like, was it really happening, or were you going to the movies in song form?
I was going to the movies, but to me, I didn't know the line.
I'm John Schaefer. You're listening to Soundcheck. We're broadcasting a new Radio Lab piece called Straight Outta Chevy Chase. It's about Peter Rosenberg, DJ at the New York hip-hop station Hot 97. He was recently the subject of a New Yorker magazine profile written by Andrew Marantz, who's also a guest. Now back to the show. Here's Jad.
Okay, so Peter goes off to college, mid-90s.
Did college radio.
Hip-hop show. And then, as he gets out, decides he wants to do this for real.
He secretly, you know, wanted to be a hip-hop DJ, but people were not taking him seriously.
You know, white kid from the suburbs, didn't compute.
He couldn't get on what was then called urban radio.
So I ended up doing a year on the Howard Stern station.
He was doing, like, talk radio, you know.
WHFS, which I was part-time.
Whatever kind of radio. So he kept calling Hot 97, and the program director then was a white guy from Utah.
You know, I gave him my spiel. I was like, I'm super passionate about hip-hop. I'm super honest. I don't think there's ever been someone who looks like me and is from my background who has as honest and loud a voice as me. I really think I'll be something different. And he basically said, I don't doubt you.
But no, what are you talking about? I mean, they had token white people on various shows, but it was either you're super white, like Lisa G, she was on the morning show for a little while.
I remember that.
She was super white.
And that was kind of the joke.
Or you were Bobby Condors, who does the Sunday night reggae show, who you would never know he's white. Because he just talks like he's Jamaican and he only plays Jamaican music, he only hangs out with Jamaican people. So you had to be one of those two things.
Where you denied your whiteness or you just were like, I'm gonna
be the butt of the joke.
White bosses have often been like, you're really talented, but I don't know, would people really like you? Like, we don't... They talk to me the way we're talking right now and think, if I'm able to relate to you this way, why would our audience relate to you?
If I say yes, then why would my audience say yes with me?
Because they assume their audience is so different than them.
Which might have been true for a while.
And then
2007,
Ebro Darden took over.
Ebro Darden in the building. What's up, man?
How you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, man.
On air, Ebro.
A half black, half Jewish guy from Oakland, and he got it.
Did hip-hop had changed?
It's no longer so small and simple and provincial that we can go on pretending this is only a black and Latino thing.
So when Peter came to the station and gave him the pitch...
Hey, I'm PMD.
Which was my old name back then.
Because I'm P for Peter and MD for Maryland. You can call me PMD. And Ebro was like, no, you're Rosenberg.
Ebro gave me my parents' name, more or less. He was like, the hook is that's your name.
Hot 97, Peter Rosenberg, Summer Jam, 2007.
There's a video on YouTube of, it's called, I think, Peter Rosenberg Does Summer Jam 2007. And it was my first day on the job.
Summer Jam is the biggest event of the year at Hot 97. It's this big show at Giant Stadium.
All the top acts.
I showed up there, and so my first day was just walking in a Giant Stadium, parking my car by myself, getting a backstage pass, and being given a mic flag that says Hot 97, the place I've always wanted to work, and being told, go up to all the famous artists who are here and just get interviewed. And if you go back and watch that video and see how much of an ass I make of myself, I say... To T.I., I think I go, is this your first Summer Jam?
First T.I., have you done a Summer Jam before?
And he looks at whoever he's with, and they both start laughing.
I'm asking, have you done many Summer Jams?
Say it's your first day on the job.
My first day on the job.
I could tell.
And I cannot believe in retrospect I survived this day.
Cypress Sounds and Rosenberg Show with K-Fox on Hot 97.
Not only survived, he became the host of two shows on Hot 97, a late night underground show and also the big weekday morning show.
And Rosenberg's brand is all about realness.
The realness.
His segment in the morning is called The Realness. His late night show, Sunday night to Monday morning,
Real Late with Peter Rosenberg,
is called Real Late with Peter Rosenberg. Mm. It's all real, real, real.
It's going to be real.
Is it real?
Because that's the central question. Can I be a real hip-hop guy even though I'm Peter Rosenberg from suburban Maryland?
Well, I think you're raising an interesting point. Most outsiders rarely become insiders.
But Peter says the key to understanding him is that he's kind of both. Like, on the one hand, he is this suburban white kid from Maryland. He doesn't pretend to be anything but. But on the other hand?
I mean, a big part of Rosenberg's job is to go to shows and blogs and get tapes from people and find the new thing. So he has a stable of like 20 or 30 underground artists who are making tapes and, you know, trying to pass around beats.
And what's more insidery than that? Plus,
he is like a purist.
I've always liked... there's a certain pure form of hip-hop. And because...
You know,
that,
in the kind of rap nerd community, they talk about certain things that are like lyrics and listening for the metaphors and the intricacies of the music. They talk about boom-bap beats.
skilled in the trade of that old boom bap.
Big sounding, drum wise. It's
boom bap, like a
kick, snare, kicks and hi-hat.
Boom bap, original rap.
It's just a feeling of sound, of energy.
This is Ali.
Ali Shaheed Muhammad. A Tribe Called Quest.
We call him up because he is the DJ and producer for A Tribe Called Quest. And for Peter, Tribe, they're the prototype.
I was obsessed with them.
They were, they are, like that shiny red apple. They defined the category. And in fact,
I guess up until my wedding weekend,
best weekend of his life, he says, or I guess now it would be his second best, was when I was
14.
And you went to a Tribe show.
It was everything I ever dreamed a hip-hop concert experience would be.
He says he spent the whole time at the front of the stage waving this hat around that said Dogs.
D-A-W-G-S.
Because one of the lead rappers was named Fife Dog.
And I held up my Dogs hat so much at the concert that eventually The Fife Dog acknowledged me the same way I would do now if I was hosting and someone kept doing it. He just gave me the hand like, I got it. You can put the hat down now.
This was a weird moment for hip-hop, not just for Peter, but for hip-hop in general, like the early 90s. This was a moment when you had stations like Hot 97 converting to all hip-hop formats, playing, you know, NWA, Public Enemy, Tribe Called Quest, groups, you know, that were suddenly attracting loads of white suburban fans. And yet, if you listen to their lyrics, some of them at least, they were about stuff those fans could have never experienced.
Struggle, oppression, lack of opportunities in the ghettos. The fact that you have young black teenagers who are living in a society where they're told that they will never amount to anything and that their lives have no value, no worth. That, to me, becomes the angst and the frustration and the rage, which is the embodiment of the music.
I wanted to be a part of this, of black culture. Like, I've always been very interested in loving things that required defense.
And hip-hop is definitely that. From the beginning, it was initially shunned by black radio because it was thought to be indecent. Then you had the whole Tipper Gore thing.
I love things like that. I don't know why. And I think I do always see hip-hop in that sort of light, in the way that it needs defense.
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power.
You're listening to Straight Outta Chevy Chase, a new Radiolab podcast that we're presenting here on Soundcheck today. Coming up, Peter Rosenberg of Hot 97 talks about his spat with rapper Nicki Minaj. This is Soundcheck.
I'm blazing, feels like I'm blazing, feels like I'm blazing.
How could it be? Little me had the power to be the best beat in the league, yeah, inevitably. But could it be little me? You was heckling me, now it's monotony when it regularly. Yo, I catch wreck on recreation, so I exceed all your expectations.
I'm John Schaefer. Today on Soundcheck, our friends at Radiolab have given us a new segment to broadcast called Straight Outta Chevy Chase. It was sparked by a recent New Yorker profile about Peter Rosenberg, a DJ at the New York hip-hop station Hot 97. And as you've been hearing, Jad and Robert from Radiolab are talking with both Peter Rosenberg and Andrew Marantz, who wrote the article. Now it's time for Jad to bring up the elephant in the room.
Can we talk about your fracas with Nicki Minaj?
Of course. That's my paragraph, so, too. If God forbid I drop dead tomorrow. It's Peter Rosenberg on Hot 97, blah, blah, blah. Next paragraph. In 2012...
Nicki Minaj is this rapper from Queens. Hugely talented rapper.
Oh, wait. She's not the one on American Idol,
yeah.
Is she? Oh, okay. Now I have a face for the name.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And she kind of blew everyone away on this Kanye song called Monster. You know, she was with all these big rappers, and Jay-Z was on the song, and she blew everyone out of the water.
First things first, I'll eat your brain. Then I'ma start rocking gold teeth and fangs. Cause that's what I'm gonna make a monster do. Hairdresser from Milan, that's the man.
I thought she was really good. I thought she was a natural and beautiful. Like, I thought she was the total package.
Wait, I'm the rookie, but my
In fact, The year before it all happened,
2011,
I pulled her aside at Summer Jam and I said, hey, I think you could be the greatest female artist of all time, the greatest female rap artist of all time. Wow. And I just want you to know that in thinking that, I'm going to hold you to a high standard. So I probably will say things about you.
You said all of that?
Yeah. In a really quick moment, too. It was really brief. She probably wouldn't even remember it, but it happened.
I would remember that if someone said that.
And I said, I think you could be the greatest.
She had all this underground cred, right? And then how did she spend that cred? Well, she started making poppier and poppier records.
Culminating in the following song, which, if you are me, you've not been able to get out of your head for a week.
She made this song called Starships.
Let's go to the beach, each, let's go get a wave. They say what they gonna say, have a drink.
Starships is a blatant pop song.
Lowest common denominator.
So I didn't like the song.
You listen to that song and you cannot tell that it's not a song by Katy Perry or Pink, or it could be anyone. So all of a sudden, who is the underground cred cop?
Cypher Sounds and Rosenberg Show.
But Peter Rosenberg.
Sometimes I gotta keep it real. Can I, though, for a second?
Several mornings for his segment called The Realness, he would get on there and play a clip of Starship.
Check out this hip-hop. If that's hardcore hip-hop, then would this song be considered another hardcore hip-hop song? That's not fair. That's not fair. Maybe she's just, you know,
there is a real question being asked at the center of this, which is, what is this music? Where the boundaries are? And also, is this where hip-hop is going? Is it just, let me cash in and just follow the trends of what white music is doing?
It would be too strong to call it, like, you felt betrayed as a music fan.
Yeah, it felt like, come on. In the moment, it felt like, You're a hip hop star. Why would you do this? This is not for us. When core hip hop artists make pop songs, it upsets me because it can be a moment that blurs and messes up hip hop.
To be frank, this song right here, Starship, is literally one of the most sellout songs in hip hop history.
Just to put that comment in a little tiny bit more context for just a second. Now, we mentioned, of course, the history, right? That so many forms of popular music have been invented by black people, co-opted by white people, jazz, blues, rock, we all know the story. Now, according to Franny Kelly,
one of the hosts of a podcast called Microphone Check,
which is a hip-hop podcast
from NPR Music.
According to her,
2013 was the first year that no black artist had a number one song. And
since 1958, since they started the Hot 100 charts, this is the first year where no black artist has made it to number one. Now, this may be a blip, may not be, but what's clear is that there is a new force in town, a style of music called EDM.
EDM is a meaningless acronym that stands for electronic dance music. And it's like, you know,
it's more like an oomph, oomph, oomph than a boom bap.
It's sort of an amalgam of synthy, dancey, techno-y, Euro-poppy stuff, and it has taken over.
What happened with EDM was just so glaring and fast. And then to see that sort of start to creep into hip-hop was scary for people.
Because according to Franny Kelly, what's scary is that EDM is a style of music that's meant to work on any dance floor with any crowd. So in a way, it's like a music without history on purpose.
A lot of the criticism of like EDM is that it is all about money. It is the corporatization of a genre with a long history. So in some ways, I think the root of the protest is, don't sell our stuff to the highest bidder.
You're listening to Soundcheck, a special presentation of a new Radiolab piece about what's hip-hop and what's not. It's called Straight Outta Chevy Chase.
After
one of the most sellout songs in hip-hop history.
Whoa.
Whoa.
Listen to it!
After Peter Trash Talks Nicki Minaj's Starships, we arrive at that year's Summer Jam.
2012.
And that year, Nicki Minaj was going to be one of the big headliners.
Plan was for her to perform on the main stage inside Giant Stadium.
But outside the stadium in the parking lot,
earlier in the day,
there's the festival stage, which is where the underground backpack kids hang out. And that's Rosenberg's zone. So he's introducing the acts on that stage.
Now, hold on. Before I get to the real hip-hop of the day,
Because I see the real hip-hop heads sprinkled in here. I see them.
I said, in trying to hype up this crowd,
I know there's some chicks here waiting to sing Starships later. I'm not talking to y'all right now. F*** that bullshit.
Crowd kind of goes, ooh, and cheer a little bit. Like, there's a cheer. Nothing crazy, though. Just a regular cheer. It's not like I didn't realize a bomb was dropped. I forgot that not only was the festival stage live streaming, but it was live streaming on her website.
And her core fans,
her barbs, as they're known,
are 13-year-old girls.
And when they see Peter say that,
they go wild. And they go out on the internet saying, who is this Rosenberg guy? What is his deal?
And he says within minutes,
it got back to Nikki and her people.
Before she went on stage?
Before she went on stage.
Oh, this is interesting.
So then there's this backstage conversation. Rosenberg, basically, as soon as he gets off stage, his boss...
My boss comes out, pokes his head around the curtain and goes, did you say something about Nicki Minaj? I was like, And I legit didn't remember. I'm like, oh, yeah, I did. And he's like, yeah, well, she just canceled the show. So she's not coming. And what? I was like, oh. And I looked at my phone and I go to Twitter. Sitting on the stage, the crowd's all out there. I'm at Giant Stadium. And I look on Twitter and I go to trends. And on the main trend page, it just says Peter Rosenberg. And I was like, oh, wow. This is nuts. This is a Sunday afternoon at like 5 o'clock. And I was like the third most trending thing in the world. I was just watching my name get bigger in a moment.
One of the big dramas that happened in New York.
I was reading just my name over and over and over again.
The dude Rosenberg, the dude from Hot 97.
Peter Rosenberg.
All these people saying, I don't know who this guy is, but he's dissing my favorite artist.
I'm just really disappointed, and I don't understand how she...
I was reading, who is this guy?
What he said, that Starship song was not hip-hop.
Peter Rosenberg.
Man, that's not real hip-hop. One man say one thing, and everybody suffers for this.
He must have gotten some serious cred from this.
Yes. Not only was his name getting out there, but it was getting out there as I'm the gatekeeper.
I'm the defender.
I'm the defender of the realness.
I couldn't appreciate it at first because I didn't know if I was maybe going to get fired for messing up Summer Jam.
Because Nikki isn't beefing with the station.
I wouldn't dare come on your stage or even say something to my fans.
She's calling in, you know, mad at the station.
You better apologize to Nikki.
Busta Rhymes gets involved. He's trying to broker a deal. Funkmaster Flex gets involved.
We exchange some emails.
They're trying to reach a detente.
Wow.
It becomes a months-long process.
Nuts.
If they say unanimously, no, you were wrong about that song. This is our song. We included in our map of what's going on. Stop trying to draw the map. What do you say to that inside of you?
I think my gut reaction is, you know nothing. You don't draw the map. You need people like us to draw the map, or there's nothing, or what is there? If we don't get to determine certain things, who does? We should leave that to the crazed 13-year-olds who may not even like this artist in 2 years?
As a woman hearing that...
It's Franny Kelly again.
This idea that young girls will hear Starships and say, oh, that's hip-hop. That's what I want to hear. That's what I'm going to judge everything against is wildly unfair to the intelligence of young girls.
Franny says they can figure out the difference between hip-hop and pop. They don't need help.
It's insulting.
And furthermore,
when he chose Starships to single out, it felt revealing of another layer to this debate that people weren't saying out loud.
Which is it, when people refer to things as, quote,
real hip-hop,
that's usually code for aggressive, street, masculine.
Authentic.
Whereas when they say pop, that's usually code for
feminine, which is a perversion of the music, period. And so there is this idea that, you know, people make songs for the ladies, which implies that all the rest of them are songs that we can't hear or, God forbid, understand.
Okay, so all of this was swirling around, months go by,
and then...
Fast forward.
To the week before the next Summer Jam.
This is 2014? 2013, I mean?
2013, yeah.
The feud is still going.
At this point, it's a year later.
But, according to Andrew, Nikki decides it's time to settle. Maybe because she wanted to perform at that year's Summer Jam.
So,
Nicki Minaj sits down with radio station Hot 97 to clear the air with DJ Peter Rosenberg.
She comes to the station before Summer Jam to make her peace. And they do this whole interview with Rosenberg and Nicki Minaj, and Ebro, the boss, is moderating.
Ooh. On the air?
On the air.
Rosenberg, so this is on you, sir. Where would you like this interview to go?
I don't know. I'm excited to see Nicki because it's very odd to have someone that you don't know very well who's become like such a fixture in your life. Like, I've always wondered. I was always like, I wonder if Nicki knows that she's come up every day in my life for 350 days. Like, point that where Starships got played at my wedding, and it was like the biggest deal at my wedding was Starships playing at my wedding.
After some opening remarks, Peter basically apologizes.
I am sorry that things went as left as they did. I never had ill feelings about you as a human being, ever.
Basically says, I have nothing against you as a person.
Beyond my sort of distaste for that song.
That's cool. It's water under the bridge.
Do you mean that?
Yeah.
She then goes out of her way to apologize to her fans for skipping out on the gig.
But,
then the gloves come off.
You know what? Like, I get it. Like, that's what you do. I guess to me, I just don't know your resume. You know what I'm saying? So I never found you funny. I never found you entertaining. I never found you smart. I just found you annoying because, you know, I grew up in New York. I've grown up on Hot 97. Like, I know Angie and I know Flex and Mr. C and all these people. Whether they like me or whether or not we get along, I just know their resume. But like with you, I was just like, who are you?
I don't recognize you as an authority on what's authentic.
To me, you don't have enough of a resume to make those comments.
Who are you to tell me what to do?
What people don't understand is that when I was doing this, I took a lot of from people, from men.
She was like, my whole career, there have just been random men who have like been in a position to stop me and tell me why I'm not good enough.
I just dealt with a lot of stuff from guys.
And here you are. I don't know you. You're just some random man. And then Ebro jumps in and kind of jokingly trying to lighten the mood goes,
and you're white.
I didn't even say that.
White boy.
She never implied anything about white. Well, she implied the man.
I did.
And then she jumps in and goes, no, that too.
Being white also struck a chord with me, if I'm being honest, because I was like, yo, he's on a black station dissing black people. Like, I just didn't like the feel of it.
And here you get back to that idea, that category idea, that like, when you don't have that like set list of criteria to help you figure out who's in and who's out, it's all about a gut feeling. And to Nicki Minaj at that moment, to have a white guy from the suburbs tell her, a black woman from Queens, that she's not hip-hop enough, it just felt wrong. But then Ali Shaheed Muhammad from Tribe Called Quest put it this way. Maybe it feels wrong, but maybe this is actually evolution.
40 years into it, that's what it's supposed to be. At some point, we're all going to be so far removed from the origin that no one would then qualify, really. But if you're going to be the person to carry the torch, I guess, to be the gatekeeper, then at some point, what qualifies you? It's your heart. It's that feeling. You could be Bill Gates' kid and still understand the struggle enough to be like, yo, I'm riding with that.
Yeah.
And I want to fight for that.
I was like, yo, he's on a black station dissing black people. Like, I just didn't like the feel of it.
Who am I going to diss if not black people? I'm on a hip-hop station. I have to diss black people sometimes. If I diss white rappers.
Absolutely not. You watch your mouth, sir.
You only want me to go at Miller? I mean, who am I going to go
at? Macklemore.
And Macklemore.
We have plenty of artists now.
I used to only diss white rappers, but as I've gotten further along, I felt I earned the right to diss all things
all
I didn't like.
Races. Okay.
I was like,
no, we was
get on the boat.
Should have been waiting with the ratchets, man.
I don't know who Nicki have out here.
Rosenberg to this day takes credit for her saying, my next project is going to be a hardcore hip-hop album.
When her album's awesome, you will see me take lots of credit for it. Absolutely. She called me the other day, and I was half asleep. And she's like, hello? I know you're thinking, why is this bitch calling me? And I was like, not at all. What's going on? And she wanted to ask me about her new song. And the amazing thing was she wanted to ask me an opinion on something. And it makes me feel ultimately super special.
So we asked Peter, like, so what does that mean? Like, if you are now a gatekeeper, you, white guy from suburban Maryland, on a very commercial radio station, what does that mean for hip-hop? Does that mean that hip-hop has by default been co-opted? Because, like, here you are.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like hip-hop is in a better place now than before I started
doing this, I would break it down on paper and go, let me tell you where we were when I started my underground show in 2007, and let me tell you where I think we are in 2014. And let me show you how many of those artists I broke and supported and worked hard with and talked to the label about and pushed, and how many I had an involvement with. I think you'd see a really high percentage.
So that was part of his answer. We asked Andrew the same question.
It's complicated. I mean, I don't think that hip-hop is dead. There was some quote, Frank Zappa, I think, said, jazz isn't dead, it just smells funny. Like, I don't think hip-hop
that's
is...
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, that should be our title.
Hip-hop isn't dead, it just smells funny.
But I think hip-hop isn't dead, it just smells funny.
It always smells a little funky.
You're listening to Soundcheck, a special presentation of a new Radiolab piece about what's hip-hop and what's not. It's called Straight Outta Chevy Chase. Tomorrow on the show, Kiss was just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame after years of being denied entry. We'll talk with the band's frontman, Paul Stanley. Plus, Stephen Levin played bass guitar in bands during college. These days, he's a New York City Council member representing the 33rd District. Councilman Levin joins us with three favorite tracks in our occasional series that we call Pick Three. Plus, jazz meets poetry meets beatboxing in the music of Roy Nathanson. He and his band will play live. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.